You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 1st of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1700 in Sydney, 9am in Istanbul, 7am here at Midori House in London, and 2am in Washington DC. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, local elections in Turkey. In Istanbul, the opposition holds its ground, causing a major setback for President Erdogan and his party. Also ahead on today's programme, India splashes out on a fence along the border with Myanmar. Who do they want to keep out? We'll ask whether Australia is suffering from a diplomatic deficit, and then...
If we talk about the 80,000 flats that are vacant, we estimate that we can mobilize like 50% of that. And that would add to those flats that are newly developed and newly built.
Can Austria's vacancy tax help to ensure enough housing is available for everyone? And our newspaper review comes from the Slovenian capital of Ljubljana.
Croatia's president is defying a court campaign kibosh ahead of this month's parliamentary elections. You can hear all about that and the rest of the news from the Balkans with me, Guy Delaunay.
Thank you, Guy. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. Tens of thousands of people have demonstrated in Jerusalem against Benjamin Netanyahu's government. A Hamas official says the group and Israel are too far apart for any discussions to progress. Romania and Bulgaria have become the latest members of Europe's Schengen area for free movement, but only for air and sea crossings. And journalists have been told to stop stealing things from the US presidential plane Air Force One. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, let's begin the programme with an update on Turkey's regional elections. This weekend's polls were a test to see just how much power the country's President Erdogan can rely on, with the battle for Istanbul at the heart of the fight. Well, as we go to air and with 98% of the votes counted, the main opposition party, CHP, seems to be on course to hold key positions in major cities, including Istanbul and Ankara. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by Victoria Craig, a journalist based in Turkey. She's joining me on the line from Istanbul. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we have, it's a pleasure to have you. So we have the results in now. Most of the ballot boxes counted. And it's not just CHP, the opposition party, holding key positions in major cities. They now appear to be winning more cities than the ruling government's party.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think how one person put it to me, many analysts I spoke to ahead of the election put it to me that this is not an election, a race that's really about local issues. This is a referendum essentially on President Erdogan and his ruling AK party. And that is what we've seen. The results that we've seen at the ballot boxes all across the 81 provinces of Turkey really show that. It's an interesting electoral map. People are referring to it as a red wave because the opposition CHP, their main color is red. And you can see just how many cities and provinces it's either retaken control of in this election or for the first time taken control of. And as you hinted there in the beginning, it is several of Turkey's biggest cities, including here in Istanbul, the commercial capital, home to a fifth of Turkey's population, the capital Ankara, and a city called Izmir, which is also one of the closely watched races here. And crucially, too, in the middle of the country, it's what we refer to as the Anatolian heartland. It's home to sort of working class people, secular Muslims who have for decades backed President Erdogan. And now they're starting to question their support for him. And so we've seen that in these results today, voting for the opposition and a couple of other sort of spoiler parties that have sprung up to steal votes away from the AK party this election.
How important was it for the AK party and by association, President Erdogan, to hold on or to, in the case of Istanbul, to recapture the vote?
Yeah, it was really important. And you could see that from just how much campaigning he himself did. You'd be forgiven for thinking that it was his name on the ballot this election in many cities. I mean, I felt like every time I opened social media, he was in a new city, a new province, campaigning before thousands of people, huge crowds. And I think it's important to say, you know, I've been asked a lot, like, does this mean that Turkey doesn't support President Erdogan? Clearly, he won last year's general election in a historic second round, to be fair. But there are a lot of people in this country who do still support the president and his policies. I think this election just shows that people have grown tired of the economic difficulties with the country. But for President Erdogan, to answer your question, winning back control of some of these cities, particularly Istanbul, was really important. He began his political career here. He was raised here. You know, this city is important, but it's also a place, the huge city budget, $16 billion in the municipal budget that goes to control a whole host of different city services. So it's a really crucial city to Turkey and to President Erdogan himself. And I think just also if his party had taken back control, that would have been a sign that people here especially and across the country, you know, would have continued to support his policies. But as I said, this was really seen as a referendum on his years in power, but particularly when it comes to the economy, his handling of that. And in his concession speech last night, he did say that people are tired of elections in this country. And it's true. We're less than a year out from three elections. We had two last year, two rounds of the general election, and then this one this time. So people are tired. And he did say that this marks a turning point, a chance to compensate for our mistakes, and that the winner was democracy. So acknowledging defeat in that speech last night.
Tell us a little bit more. Two questions rolled into one here. What has gone wrong for Erdogan and his AKP party to warrant such a big shift to the opposition? And as a result of that, what's the opposition done well to beat Erdogan?
Well, the economy, I think, is far and away the biggest issue for people in Turkey. And it's sort of an old talking point. I mean, the economy has been something that people have suffered from. Inflation now hovering just under 70%. And at the same time, interest rates have reached 50%. The central bank raised them about 2 weeks ago to 50%. And I think the irony sort of this election is that President Erdogan, when he won the general election last year, he put a new economic and finance team in place with the goal of getting inflation under control. And so they have set out, embarked on this policy. They have raised interest rates in almost every month that they've been in control to 50%, as I said. But the thing is that the president himself has been enacting fiscal policies that counteract those monetary policies. And the biggest was he increased minimum wage by 49% at the beginning of this year. And all that did was put more money in people's pockets. And that was money that they felt they had to spend, because prices are rising. And so it just fuels this spending sort of frenzy, and it fuels inflation. And you can't get either one under control if the policies aren't in sync. So the president did acknowledge that he said in his concession speech last night that we're going to start seeing positive results in the second half of this year, starting with inflation. But the big question is whether he's going to continue to go along with these economic policies that he's allowed his team to put in place. And so I think while the economy worked against the president and his party, it sort of worked for the opposition, because the opposition could say, look, this is something we know that the economy is something that's hurting, you know, your household finances. Here in Istanbul, Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, who won re-election, has done a lot of things in Istanbul to try to offset the effects of the high inflation for people. He's done things like open municipal restaurants that offer a huge discount on entire meals for people. He has municipal bread shops that people can go for discounted items, and free travel cards for mothers with children under 3 years old. So things like that, just to try to take a little bit of the sting away. And so clearly that was a message that resonated with voters this time.
You mentioned a moment ago that President Erdogan, for possibly one of the first times in his career, publicly conceded defeat and then promised that things would change. What happens now? Because the defeat is very, very loud. It's very significant, and it has international repercussions as well. But most importantly, what happens to the way that Turkey is going to vote in the future?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm not sure anybody really knows the answer, because I was scrolling through social media this morning, and one of the economic analysts I routinely talk to was pointing out that, you know, you can't discount President Erdogan. He has suffered defeats before and been able to battle back from those. And so he still has 4 years as president. And there was talk before this election that he could embark on a constitutional change to potentially allow him to run again, potentially under a parliamentary system rather than the current presidential one. And so that's an option. As I say, you can never count him out. And I think that is what you've seen with him admitting this defeat, acknowledging that the economy is an issue, pledging that he's going to change it. But I think also the CHP, for its part, and we heard from its chairman yesterday in what many people are calling a very strong speech, saying, you know, that this is the first step toward bigger victories in the future, that voters open the door to a new political climate here in Turkey. And that was, I think, the hope for the opposition, and especially Mayor İmamoğlu here in Istanbul. This election win is being seen not just as a victory here in Istanbul for him and his ability to continue governing Istanbul, but also setting him up to run potentially against President Erdogan if the constitution changes, but against the AKP's next presidential candidate in the next general election in 4 years. So clearly both sides seeing this as a real opportunity to hopefully embark on their own path toward regaining control of the country in the next election. It's always the eye toward the future.
Seizing the narrative is going to be quite an issue, though, given the fact that much of the coverage given by the pro-government media was given over to Erdogan's campaign and his daily rallies. And there was arguably limited coverage of the opposition. Now that the opposition seems to have circumvented that major sort of media issue, how do messages get across, and how do Turkish residents and Turkish citizens actually get a true sense of what is going on?
I think it's always a challenge here, specifically, as you say, with the government controlling so much of the media. It's difficult to get an unbiased view of what's happening. And we certainly saw that during this election, as you say, overwhelmingly, the president's candidates, certainly here in Istanbul as well, received substantially more coverage than Mayor İmamoğlu and his opposition party did. But I think what their strategy was just to try to talk to as many voters as they could. And if you talk to people on the street here in Istanbul, those who support Mayor İmamoğlu really like him. Many voters that I talked to, even one last night, they're a bunch of supporters. I really can't say how many thousands potentially gathered at the Metropolitan Municipality building following the election results once it was very clear that he was going to retain control. And one of the people I talked to said, you know, I just love him as a person. He is just very relatable. He's of the people. And that's something that I think a lot of his supporters say. One other campaign volunteer I spoke to last week was saying, you know, he gets on buses and he talks to people, and he can talk to children. He can talk to people, you know, in midlife. He can talk to older people, and his message resonates with everybody. And I think too, you know, as we've been talking, the economy, because it's such a huge presence in everyday life, that was something particularly for young voters, of which there were many first-time voters in this election, more than a million of them. That's something that they also think about too. You know, people in their 20s and 30s have never known a Turkey without Recep Tayyip Erdogan leading it. And so certainly in the last general election last year, that was the case, that people said, you know, I've seen the strain that my parents and grandparents are under. I understand what it's like to, you know, graduate from school and try to find a job and, you know, make my own way in life in this current economic climate. And it's difficult. And so I want change. And so, you know, I think that is certainly something that resonates with younger voters. And that's what I heard over and over again from people, just how happy they were, those supporters of Mayor İmamoğlu here in Istanbul, that they pulled off such a sizable defeat against the AKP in this election.
Victoria Craig in Istanbul, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio. Now, there are plans by India to build a fence along its border with neighbouring Myanmar. The barrier, costing more than $3.5 billion, estimated, is intended to reduce smuggling and also to prevent refugees fleeing the civil war in Myanmar from crossing into its northern territories. Well, I'm joined now by Tripur Daman Singh, who's an author and historian focused on South Asia and currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London. A very good morning to you, Tripur Daman.
Good morning, Emma.
Just explain to us about just more details as to the reason for this construction.
So there has been long-standing ethnic tensions in India's northeast for a very long time, and especially in the state of Manipur, there has been a lot of violence over the past 1 year, mostly. To an extent where a lot of the state administration has melted away. Its own police and security forces have deserted in large numbers with their arms and with their ammunition. And the violence has really been quite horrifying and ongoing for a very, very long time. And one of the reasons that the question of fencing has now come up is because it is closely tied to the ongoing civil war within Myanmar as well. And I think one of the ways that India really wants to insulate itself from what is going on in Myanmar is to build this fence. And crucially, it's not just that they want to build a fence. It's also that they've ended very recently the free movement regime, which had been instituted in 2018, allowing residents of border towns on both sides of the border to go up to 16 kilometers on either side without the need of a visa or any further administrative formalities. And that has ended as well.
Tell us a little bit more about what is behind this violence.
So there are two major communities in Manipur, which are the Maitai, who are predominantly Hindu, and the Kukis, who are now predominantly Christian. And there's been ongoing ethnic tension, which bubbled over into violence last year. And the Kukis are generally, occupy the hill tracks, and the Maitais generally occupy the towns and cities in the plains. And the government is Maitai dominated. They are a majority of the population. And the Kukis feel hard done by. To an extent where at some point last year, a large number of Kuki legislators themselves refused to attend the Manipur Legislative Assembly, alleging that there was a threat to their lives should they come to the state capital. Now, the Kukis are part of a larger ethnic group called the Kuki Zo people, which include the Mizos, who are found generally the majority in India's state of Mizoram, and also the Chin, who are the majority in the Chin state in Myanmar across the border. And there's about 400 odd kilometers of the border that Manipur shares with Myanmar. And so after the outbreak of the civil war in Myanmar following the coup in 2021, thousands, and some estimate this to be upwards of 50,000, Kuki Chin refugees have entered Manipur, and of course, many of these are not necessarily refugees, but armed insurgents fighting against the military regime in Myanmar. And there has been instances, even historically, but especially now, of gun running and cross-border trade in arms and also in drugs. If any of your listeners would know that Myanmar is part of the Golden Triangle with Laos and Cambodia for drug production, especially for heroin and poppy cultivation. So it's a very, very complex situation. And I think for India, the real challenge is both to deal with this and to prevent, in a sense, such cross-border spillovers of ethnic tension and violence.
There have been claims, though, that if you actually build a fence against a country, up on the border along a country which is in the middle of a civil war, which is prompting the flight of, as you say, upwards of 50,000 refugees across one part of it, you mm-hmm. will just worsen the situation in Myanmar. I mean, how prepared is the Indian government to let this happen?
I think it's important to remember that this is still a proposal. The actual fencing is probably going to be a very slow and very long drawn out process, as we've seen with Indian attempts to fence the border on the other side with Pakistan. And I think for India, this is going to be a very, very difficult proposition, not just because it's a hugely expensive exercise, but also the geography poses its own challenges. It's mountainous, it's forested. Crucially, there are long-standing ethnic ties across the border. And in many cases, it's hard to differentiate who is an Indian and who is from Myanmar in the absence of proper documentation. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. And there are many in India who would hope that things would settle down in Myanmar by the time the entire fence is constructed, if it is constructed at all.
Indeed, what's been the international reaction to the idea?
The international reaction has been quite tepid from what I can see. And I think there is generally a fair bit of sympathy for the Indian position. One of the things that from the Indian side, many people think, and I've heard many analysts and some government voices say this as well, is that the situation in some senses has been exacerbated by the West's sanctioning of Myanmar and America's funding of the opposition to the military regime. So there's been, I think, some almost 20 rounds of sanctions imposed by the US, and I would suspect something broadly similar by the EU and the UK, which has completely wrecked the Myanmar economy, pushing large numbers of people into unemployment and joblessness. And at the same time, the Burma Act has allowed the American state to appropriate funds to supply non-lethal assistance to the Burmese resistance, and so for many in India, in a sense, the West's attitude towards the problem is something that is exacerbating the situation on their borders rather than really, you know, helping solve it. And also, just if I could quickly mention, it's also on the other side. I mean, ASEAN has kicked Myanmar off the table, and so for really, India is in quite a difficult situation, and I think there is generally sympathy for India's predicament.
Tripodaman Singh, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
So the group is still seeking to hit a number of targets to further its goal, messaging to its supporters around the world that it remains both a potent force and a relevant force.
Following its attack on the Moscow Concert Hall, how big of a threat is Islamic State? Find out more on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
In Ljubljana, which is where we head next to have a look at today's newspapers. Guy Delaunay is Monocle's Balkans correspondent, and I'm delighted to say he joins us on the line now for a round of headlines from the region. A very happy Easter to you, Guy.
Happy Easter to you too as well, Emma. I hope the Easter bunny brought you all sorts of lovely chocolate gifts.
No, but the Easter brunny did.
Easter brunny, okay.
How about
I like
you?
The sound of that.
Did lots of little eggs land in your nest this weekend?
They did, actually. So, you know, I'm several pounds heavier than I was at the start of the weekend.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait to see you. You're coming over to London next week, aren't you? So we'll try and
Indeed.
We'll get
I will be presenting some dailies. So looking forward to that.
We'll get you another seat on the plane. Guy, what have you... Have you found in the papers where you are?
Well, what we've got is Croatia's president, as one headline puts it, making Croatian politics interesting again. And this is Zoran Milanovic, who is the president of Croatia, the head of state. And he is, in effect, running as a candidate to become prime minister on April the 17th, despite the fact that the constitutional court has told him he must do no such thing. And he has turned around and said, court, schmort, I'm campaigning anyway. See if they can stop me.
Right. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about whether they can stop him.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, the Constitutional Court is, of course, the highest authority in Croatia in terms of the judiciary. And in essence, it could annul the elections if the elections are not being conducted, the campaign isn't being conducted in a way which is in accordance with the Constitution. Now, it's ruled that the head of state cannot be a candidate in the parliamentary elections, unless, of course, the president chooses to resign. Zoran Milanovic is choosing to do no such thing at the moment. So now we've got a little bit of a battle of wills which is being set up. Zoran Milanovic saying if the court decides to annul the elections, it will be a coup d'etat. On the other hand, the government, which is not from the same party as Zoran Milanovic, is saying that the president is committing something of a coup d'etat himself by attempting to run for prime minister when the Constitutional Court has said nope.
Tell us a little bit more about how the papers are covering this.
Well, they're in essence saying, as I said, one of the headlines, I'll give you one, for example, from Balkan Insight, which is an English language one, but I think it's fair enough because we get a bit of an overview from this. They say that Zoran Milanovic is making Croatian politics interesting again. Now, this is a double-edged sword. They're not speaking in praise of Zoran Milanovic here. Let me be quite clear about that. But what they're saying is that generally the elections in Croatia have been pretty predictable since it became independent in 1991. At any given point, you're likely to find the HDZ in government. The HDZ is the centre-right, sometimes right-wing, nationalist Croat party, which has dominated Croatia's politics all throughout those 30-odd years. Zoran Milanovic is from the SDP, the Social Democrats. He has been prime minister in the past from 2011 to 2016. It wasn't a particularly successful time. It was marked by the Croatia's longest ever recession. But now he's positioned himself over the past 4 years as this populist president. And quite apart from anything else, Balkan Insight is saying that this is shaking things up. The HDZ might have been counting on carrying on their arrangement, which sees them pretty much dictating who does what in Croatia from a very micro local level right up to the top national level. All of that is now being thrown into the mix by Mr. Milanovic, and not just his candidacy, but the fact that he's chosen, and he could do this, he set the election date for a Wednesday, the earliest possible election date, after Prime Minister Andrei Plenković has decided to dissolve the government. President Milanovic just said, right, we'll have it as early as possible. It'll be Wednesday, April the 17th. Elections in Croatia are always on a Sunday. So straight away, he's shaking things up. And this is at least making people think, what do they want from this next government? What is it going to look like? Is a Zoran Milanovic-led government going to be a good thing? And on the other hand, why do we keep electing the HDZ when we keep finding that we get a very large degree of patronage and predictability from that party?
Let's head to Belgrade to find out about how Donald Trump, or rather his extended family, might have a rather large role to play in the reconstruction of a bombed building.
And this is one of the buildings that you see first when you come into Belgrade from the airport. It depends if you take which route you take, but a lot of it will take you up one of the main boulevards in Belgrade, and you will see bombed out buildings on one side of this boulevard, which used to be the Ministry of Defence. In fact, some parts of those buildings are still functioning, and I've been around both the working and non-working parts of them. And they were bombed during the NATO airstrikes in 1999, when NATO intervened to force what were then Yugoslav troops to withdraw from Kosovo. And they've been kept in this state ever since, much in the same way that you have, say, St. Luke's Church in Liverpool remains an empty shell as a war memorial. Well, these buildings, successive governments have insisted, are in essence a monument to the people who died in Serbia during those 1999 airstrikes. And yet now there appears to be a deal in place between the government and Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to redevelop these sites as some sort of high-end hotel accommodation. And surprise, surprise, not everybody is happy about this.
Indeed, how has this come about then? Because when what you paint there is a picture of something symbolic and something which a society has accepted must never change, it's a bit of a jump to suddenly get to Jared Kushner in a hotel, isn't it?
It really is. And it's not the first time you've heard talk about the Trump family being involved in this site. I mean, when we were going back to before the time that Donald Trump was president of the United States, we heard talk that his property company might be involved in something on the very same site. So this is talk that's been around for the best part of a decade. The thing is about these buildings, you're right, they're symbolic, but not everybody has agreed that they should remain bombed out. A lot of people think that if Serbia wants to establish itself as a modern European country, it needs not to have extremely large bomb sites on one of its main boulevards, speaking of its ongoing discontent with the fact that NATO intervened in 1999 to prevent what Serbian troops, as part of the Yugoslav army, were doing in Kosovo, that it needs to move past that. So in some ways, a redevelopment needs to take place. But the idea that this redevelopment should take the form of giving what is apparently going to be a free concession to Jared Kushner is, of course, raising all sorts of questions about transparency, value, and what really should be on the site if it's going to be transformed from, you know, these current bombed-out buildings.
Guy Delaunay, thank you, as ever, for bringing us the newspapers. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's me, Emma Nelson, with today's Globalist. The time here in London is 7:30. A quick look now at the rest of today's headlines. Tens of thousands of people have demonstrated in Jerusalem against Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Protesters called for elections to replace the current government due to its handling of the crisis in Gaza. There were also rallies against the policy to exemptions granted to ultra-Orthodox Jewish men from military service. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister has temporarily handed over power to his deputy in order to have surgery for a hernia. And a Hamas official says the group and Israel are too far apart for any discussions to progress. Talks over a possible ceasefire and hostage release deal are expected to resume in Cairo this week. And it's being reported that two civilians have been injured in Israeli strikes on the outskirts of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Romania and Bulgaria have become the latest members of Europe's Schengen area for free movement, but only for air and sea crossings. Land border controls will remain in place because of Austria's opposition to the two nations becoming members of the zone. Vienna fears an influx of asylum seekers if all border controls disappear. And journalists have been told to stop stealing things from the US presidential plane, Air Force One. An inventory check on the aircraft following Joe Biden's visit to the US West Coast found pillowcases, glasses and gold-rimmed plates were among the items missing from the press section. Journalists are sometimes given small packets of M&M chocolates decorated with the presidential seal as a souvenir. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's just nudging 17:32 in Sydney, 7:32 a.m. here in London. Now, despite being the 14th largest economy in the world, Australia ranks only 26th on the Lowy Institute's Global Diplomacy Index, which measures the significance of diplomatic networks globally. China tops the list with a heavier diplomatic presence than the US in geopolitically contested regions in Asia, Africa and the Pacific. So what does this lag in diplomatic representation mean for Australia's global presence? I'm joined now from Sydney by one of the authors of the report. Ryan Neelam is a former Australian diplomat and the director of the Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Programme at the Lowy Institute. A very good afternoon to you, Ryan.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me, Emma.
Thank you for joining us. Just to explain a little bit more of the context, we're talking about the significance of diplomatic networks. Just what exactly does that mean?
That's right. So the Lowy Institute's Global Diplomacy Index basically started because there were a lot of ways to track how countries seek to project influence in the world. There are a lot of metrics on military power and military investments. There are a lot of ways to look at how countries invest in their economic clout. But diplomacy, which is the key tool of statecraft, there wasn't a way to look at how they seek to invest in diplomacy. And what we've created at the Lowy Institute is a tracker, and it's an interactive map that users can see how much different countries invest in their diplomatic networks by counting their number of posts, so their overseas embassies, consulates, and missions to international organisations. And that really gives you a proxy of how they invest in diplomacy, but also where they're seeking to project influence in the world.
Now, Australia is ranked in 26th place. I mean, this is the second time it's been pretty low on the comparatively low on the scale. I mean, is Australia doing quite badly here?
Well, look, in terms of its overall, the overall size of its network, it certainly doesn't accord with Australia's economic weight. As you pointed out, Australia is the 14th largest economy in the world. It has the 26th largest diplomatic network. So there is a disjunct there between how much it is investing compared to other countries. To give you a sense of that, it's 19th out of the 20 economies in the G20 in terms of the size of its diplomatic network. And countries that have larger diplomatic investments than Australia include Turkey, Argentina, Hungary, and Greece. All of them have invested more in their overseas networks than Australia. So comparatively, it is behind its peers when it comes to how it invests in its overseas presence. And that does, we think, have an impact in its ability to influence world events to Australia's interests.
What kind of impact are we talking about?
Well, look, Australia sees itself as a player that has global interests. It's a highly globalised trading nation. It depends on the world for its prosperity and security. And because it's a middle power, it isn't able to use the spectre of force or its economic might to shape the global environment in the same way that superpowers like US and China can. So it has to rely on the structures of the international rules-based order. And this is something that you hear when you listen to Australian politicians and Australian leaders. They're always talking about how important the rules-based world order is. Now, the way you shape that rules-based world order is through your diplomatic service, through your presence at multilateral institutions like the UN the G20, the OECD and others. And it's also how you engage with countries bilaterally, so how your overseas embassies are able to shape the countries to your interests. Now, there are a range of ways where Australia's underinvestment in diplomacy could affect it. I'll start by saying that it is very well represented in its own region, and that is appropriate because Australia, the weight of Australia's economic and security interests are in the Indo-Pacific. But where it lacks resources are further abroad in Latin America and in Africa, where Australia has a very slim presence compared to like-minded countries or countries of similar economic weight. And that could impact on its ability to shape a more fractured world order where we're moving beyond an American-centric world order to an arrangement where there's contestation for power from not only from China but also from other countries like India, from rising powers in Africa and Latin America. So those things are going to impact on Australia's global interests, but also Australia's ability to be elected onto key world bodies like the UN Security Council and the Human Rights Council. These are both bodies that have important roles in upholding the world order. Australia will need a better representation in developing countries to be elected, but also to serve credibly in those arenas.
Ryan Neelam, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, in 2014, when the Islamic State was at its peak, they controlled about a third of Syria and 40% of Iraq. That's a territory larger than Iceland. Well, since losing its final strongholds in the region to Western-backed forces, the group has been operated at a greatly diminished level. But recent IS activity, including last month's attack on a concert hall in Moscow, in which more than 140 people died, suggests the group is still a threat and focused on exploiting regional instabilities. Well, Dr. Shiraz Maher is a reader in the Department of War Studies at King's College London and a director of the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation. And a little earlier, he caught up with Monocle's Andrew Muller about the resurgence of the Islamic State.
First of all, is it fair, do you think, to say that everybody else, specifically the Western world, the likely targets of Islamic State, got a bit complacent in recent years about the degree to which the threat may have abated?
I think there has been, I don't know if it's willful ignorance, but a sort of optimistic sense of wanting to believe that the threat from Islamic State is over. It's certainly very much degraded from where it was about a decade ago when the group was at the peak of its powers and enjoying its high watermark in terms of holding territory across large parts of Syria and Iraq. And to an extent, understandably, you know, a lot of things have happened in the interim. Of course, we've had COVID, increased competition with China, Putin's invasion of Ukraine, war in the Middle East again in terms of Israel-Palestine conflict. So understandably, attention has moved on. But the real point to take away, of course, is that Islamic State never really went away. And it's continued to invest heavily in its peripheries and in its activities, both in the region and elsewhere.
In the variant of Islamic State, which claimed the attack on Moscow, this is Islamic State Khorasan, mostly based in Afghanistan, is it clear what they actually want as an organization? Is there an end game in their heads behind such violence as they enacted in Russia?
Well, I think we need to maybe examine, as it were, the headline goal of what Islamic State wants and then work backwards. So, of course, the group's ultimate aspiration has always been to hold territory and to maintain a territorial caliphate of the kind we saw, as I say, about a decade ago. That said, when it can't do that, and it clearly can't do that right now, the group is deeply invested in its own survival and is looking to further its goals by both lashing out, as it has done with the attack in Russia. But also, let's not forget, prior to that, there have been two other significant attacks this year, a huge attack in Iran back in January, and then a few weeks after that, an attack on a Catholic church in Istanbul as well. So the group is still seeking to hit a number of targets to further its goals and to keep persisting as an organization, which is A, inflicting damage and harm upon its enemies, but B, which is also messaging to its supporters around the world that it remains both a potent force and a relevant force.
You're quite right to point out that the Moscow attack is not the first this year, but when you look at them as a grouping, the bombing of a Shia funeral in Iran, an attack on a Catholic church in Turkey, and on a theater in Moscow, to whom is that range of attacks designed to appeal to? Which base are they trying to rouse?
I think there's two things. We've had, of course, the October 7th terrorist attack in Israel and the revival of the Israel-Palestine conflict, which always serves as a massive focal point of attention for jihadist groups and for lots of people in the Arab and Muslim world more generally. So within that context, when there's been a lot of people rallying to either express solidarity with the Palestinian cause and so on, ISIS has been very keen to demonstrate and to message within that context that it's still around, it's still here. And I think that was the really interesting thing that we saw in this context. So in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, ISIS said that it wanted its supporters around the world to not just target Israeli political symbols, but Jews more generally, and beyond that, Christians more generally. And in the statement claiming responsibility for what happened in Moscow, the group framed it as an attack on Christians. And of course, as you mentioned, the attack on the Catholic Mass in Istanbul obviously is a direct attack on a Christian symbol. So in that context, ISIS is trying to say, well, look, we're here, we're doing our part, what are you doing? And, you know, it's been very, very explicit. Just yesterday, in fact, the group's official spokesman put out an audio statement where he was calling for attacks on the West. And of course, in that context, you know, because the West is seen in their eyes to be supporting Israel, then this is an attempt for relevance on the global stage.
I mean, does it therefore follow that the rest of the West, the rest of Europe, possibly the United States, Australia, other countries broadly seen as being in that cohort, should brace themselves for further Islamic State attacks of the kind that we saw in Moscow and indeed in Istanbul? Is a new wave of this sort of thing likely?
Sadly, I think it's almost inevitable now that some kind of attack will take place in the West. And that's not just speculation. Back in January, the Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police said that they were facing an unprecedented spike in the caseload, again, relating to the terrorist threat because of what had happened in Gaza and the subsequent fallout from that. So it's important to recognize that, you know, these terrorist groups and terrorist actions in this context, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's deeply linked to events that are happening around the world. And so ISIS is clearly seeking to exploit events in the Middle East. It's seeking to exploit what's happening in Gaza to further its own cause and agenda. And so in that context, while people are primed with lots of anger, groups like this are seeking to move into that space and to inspire and motivate their followers to do something.
Is it clear, though, what the group is now doing just for the basic necessities of being a militant terrorist organization with global ambition? Do we know where the weapons and where the money comes from?
Well, in lots of cases, groups like Islamic State haven't been all that sophisticated in terms of how they fundraise. They're kind of doing what they've always done. They are utilizing extortion in a number of areas, and there's lots of evidence to show that in some parts of Afghanistan, they are extorting local populations to generate income. They also, of course, are involved in things like the drug trade, kidnapping in order for ransoms. And that's happening both in Syria and Iraq. That's happening in Afghanistan. And of course, the group, or its various chapters at least, are also relatively active across large parts of Africa. So they are retaining a sort of economic empire, as it were, which is continuing to fuel aspects of their activity. And these things, you know, they don't cost huge amounts of money. These aren't particularly sophisticated attacks as we saw in Istanbul or in Moscow. These are simply marauding gun attacks, which are relatively low cost for the organization.
You mentioned there that there is an Islamic State branch slash franchise, offshoot, whatever, operating in West Africa. Do we know how unified that organization is with the Islamic State we've been talking about? I'm just wondering if we make a bit of a category error when we refer to them as if they were all one single cohesive organization.
Well, exactly. It's important not to ascribe too much to it and also not to play it down. And by that, I mean, in all of these cases, and it's not just West Africa, in places like Mozambique and elsewhere as well in Africa, the group does have a presence. It is active. Now, in all of these cases, local dynamics are very much at play, which influence the fortunes of the movement in those areas, which also play into why an individual might choose to associate with that movement. So the reasons why someone might be affiliating with Islamic State in West Africa will be different to in Syria and Iraq, and that will be different to what's happening in Afghanistan. Nonetheless, there is a sort of overarching ideological umbrella by which these groups are united. They do all swear allegiance to the central leadership of the organization, which is presumed to be hiding out somewhere in the Syrian desert. And then more broadly, there is still a loose sense of command and control, but clearly these local chapters do have a degree of localized autonomy as well, within which they will seek to act.
That was Shiraz Maher there in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Muller. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. Now, the government in Austria plans to introduce a nationwide vacancy tax on owners of empty properties. Four of the country's nine states are already charging a fee on unoccupied homes, but the proposed new legislation would grant the same powers to the other five and authorise regional governments to set the rates as they see fit. Well, the idea has predictably drawn criticism from some politicians and homeowners groups, but its supporters say it'll allow to bring as many as 650,000 1,000 homes across the country back into use. That's a huge number for a nation of just 9 million. On Monocle's Alexei Korolev reports now from Vienna, where the measure would target around 80,000 flats.
Vienna's authorities are rightly proud of their housing policies. Although property prices are on the rise, rents remain affordable, especially in public and subsidised housing. But just like in the rest of the country, there are supply problems.
The city of Vienna is growing. We had approximately over the last 10 years 200,000 new inhabitants, people coming to Vienna looking for flats. And to have the housing market and the affordability of housing like in a balance, the city needs around 10,000 new available or newly built flats per year.
Peter Kraus is a Vienna city councillor and head of the Vienna branch of the Austrian Green Party. The Greens are a junior coalition partner in the country's national government and have been among the most vocal champions of the vacancy tax. Councillor Kraus explains how the tax is going to work.
Different cities in Austria are already preparing this. This would work in a way that we have a register of all the flats in Vienna. We have a register of all the,
main residences.
Main residences. And then we know which flats don't have a main residency. And then this would actually be the list of flats we can say, okay, now we ask the owners of the flats, why is there no residency in this flat? Is there a reason? Refurbishment, change of usage, I don't know. If there's no reason, you have 6 months. And after 6 months, there's the vacancy fee. And the money we should use for refurbishment of old homes, of old buildings. Vienna has a very big part of old, also affordable flats. And we could use that money to subsidize refurbishment, renovation, also maybe the change from fossil fuels to renewable fuels. Those are all, I think, subsidies that also help to, on the one hand, make affordable housing quality-wise better, but also to safeguard affordable existing homes.
Needless to say, not everybody's on board. In Parliament, critics include the far-right Freedom Party, the third largest, and the Liberal Neos Party. Both say the tax would pose a threat to people's property rights and have called for a rethink, although they don't have the numbers to stop it from getting through. But there's opposition outside of Parliament too.
Jetzt hat man das den Ländern überlassen, weil sie es wollten, und sie können jetzt auf einmal auch sehr hohe Steuern auf Leerstand beziehen.
The Austrian Homeowners and Landowners Association has put out a statement that describes the proposal as part of the standard repertoire of left-wing ideologues. This despite the fact that the idea has been supported by the country's conservative chancellor, Karl Nehammer. Martin Brunbauer is head of the group, and he says he's having trouble with the very definition of vacancy.
Jetzt haben wir aber ein Problem mit dem Leerstand. Auf der einen Seite hat mir noch niemand erklären können, was Leerstand eigentlich ist.
Nobody has managed to explain to me what a vacant flat actually means, because there's many reasons for a flat to be empty. It may be about to be rented or sold. It can be in the process of refurbishment, which takes a long time. There's 1,000 other reasons. That's why I am convinced that owners have every right to keep their properties empty.
Ich dürfte auch leer stehen lassen. Die Zahlen, die hier herumgeistern, sind einfach nicht wahr.
We have estimates of 80,000 flats in Vienna that are vacant right now.
Vienna City Councillor Peter Kraus is realistic about how many flats the tax would yield, but he still believes that it's the right thing to do.
If we talk about the 80,000 flats that are vacant, we estimate that we can mobilize like 50% of that. And that would add to those flats that are newly developed and newly built. Maybe some can't be mobilized, but it gets less attractive to have investment and business models that, for example, we have seen this in Vienna a lot, you can invest in flats. You never live there. The flat gets rented out on Airbnb. It's a whole business model. No one ever lives there except for touristic reasons. And this is on the ground of sites in the city that are designed for affordable housing. And this should not work. And in total, it would mean that the market is more open, that there are more flats available, and therefore the prices are going down or at least not rising that sharp or that fast.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you very much indeed, Alexei. Now, the time here in London is 7.53. Let's finish today's programme with a look at art news. And I'm delighted to say that Amma Rose Abrams, the arts journalist, joins me in the studio. Very good morning,
good
Amma
morning.
Rose. Let's begin with a quite astonishing sale. There was Rosa de la Cruz, a great art collector, died, I think it's a little couple of months ago now, didn't she? There's a memorial service for her last month. And now her collection is already going up for sale. I mean, it seems like a really quick turnaround.
Incredibly quick. And I think there's also been a couple of pieces that have sneakily been sold before this announcement was even made. But that nobody really knows why it's being sold off so quickly. But her museum is closed. They're going to be repurposing the building. And her collection, which... it's kind of one of these beautiful collections that's just kind of really born out of a love of art and a lifelong kind of commitment.
This is in Miami, isn't it?
Yes, in Miami. Is kind of going under the hammer, and there's questions raised about it. A, because it's not the optimum time to sell these works for a lot of you, because for some of there's Anna Mendieta works in there, which I think are very hot at the moment. But there's other work that maybe isn't that cool and could probably be sold, you know, in a year for a better price. And then there's so I think there's a lot of questions around this sale, but it's Christie's who are handling it.
Indeed,
so.
It's an interesting collection, isn't it? Because, I mean, there are some things which are incredibly fashionable and not so fashionable as well. But how often does a collection like this come up?
Not often. But in America recently, there have been a few massive collections that have come up for sale, either because of divorces or someone passes away. But every time a big collection comes up for sale, it resets or kind of... it changes the market a little bit, because people have been... these works, even if they aren't trendy, are key works in the history of art. You know, she was a wonderful collector, and these are really important pieces. And so it really kind of resets the market a bit, which is on the decline at the moment and is suffering. So it kind of creates a bit of a shift.
It's also quite sad when you see the breaking up of such a beautifully assembled collection, and you think that actually, okay, this is an enormous collection and it's worth tens of millions of dollars in its entirety. But is there an argument to say, I have no idea what you could do with something of that scale, but to actually maintain it as it is?
Absolutely. I think that would be a wonderful thing to do if it was possible, because what it provides is a kind of captures a moment in time in the history of art.
Okay, let's talk about someone called Inigo Philbrick, possibly the best name I've heard today, may well be the best name I'll hear all month, and it is only April the 1st. His name is not a fool. This man is genuine, and Inigo Philbrick has done time as well. Who is he?
He is an art dealer, in inverted commas, who set up on his own, and he worked at White Cube. He was kind of loved there, set up on his own, and it wasn't really working out for him. So he decided to sell multiple shares in multiple pieces of art, some of which he didn't own, totaling 86 million.
And oh, Inigo.
Bit of a mistake.
How long did it take them to catch him?
I think not very long.
No. Now he's been in prison for that. Is he out yet? And he's now talking to the likes of Vanity Fair, isn't he?
Yes, apparently he was talking to Vanity Fair while he was in prison, and he's done a follow up with his fiance Victoria Baker Harbour, who is
who's a very patient woman.
Yeah, a very patient woman who's on Made in Chelsea. But he's written things like how struck he was that how few of the people he interacted with in prison knew what an art dealer did.
Right.
And things like this. So I don't really know if his time spent behind bars has enlightened him in any way to the realities of the world.
Is he an interesting character? I mean, his name and his background is interesting enough, but is he inherently an interesting character?
I think this is where a lot of the attention comes from, because the art world is full of fraudsters, as we know. But it's just his attitude, his maybe slight lack of self-awareness and his kind of desire to kind of ride through regardless and continue, I think makes people really fascinated with him. He's also like a really great example of these people who maybe see the market, see that it's very unregulated, and just think, I'm going to do anything that I want. And they kind of didn't really know how illegal it was.
I love that. I didn't know how illegal it was. Emma Rose Abrams, thank you so much as ever for joining me in the studio on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Vincent McAvini, Carlotta Ribello and Laura Kramer. Our researcher was Monica Lillis. Our studio manager was Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing's live at midday here in London, and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.